I don't know how many of you saw this Family Circus cartoon. The husband has his arm around the wife and he says, "Peaceful Sunday, we're all together." And then in the next picture, you see that the husband and wife are on the couch and all the kids are sitting on top of them or whatever. There are, you know, toy trucks coming out from under the cushions and newspapers are all over and the dog and the fleas and the cats and everything are there. And he said, "If it could only be this way forever." And then there's a picture of two angels up in heaven at a computer terminal. And one says, "Was that a prayer or what?" And then the other one says, "Hey Jude, here's a toughie for you." But as I saw this, I thought, there are lots of people who are in just this situation, you know, with the newspapers over the couch and the you know, animals all around and the kids lying on you while you're snuggling, and who say, "I can't wait till this is over." And our attitude affects to a tremendous degree the way we approach our task as mothers. And so I'm hoping a lot of what I share won't be new. But I remember as a young mom having just maybe a few minutes with some other mother, and it was like she just kind of pumped me up, you know, and then I was ready for another year, you know. And so I think probably, since so many of you have younger children, you just need to be pumped up, you know, and encouraged to go back in. I just want to tell you what you're doing is, I just think, I mean, it is one of the most important contributions to society, to the Christian movement, and I want to just encourage you in your task. I loved reading about, in the days of John Wesley, when there was the great revival in England, the speakers used to stand on stumps out in a field and preach to thousands of people, and there was a great movement of a turning towards God. But England was at an absolute low point at that time. I mean, we have no idea how society was turned around by that great revival. England was in the pits when that revival took place. And when John Wesley was standing on this stump preaching, there was a man who used to come to hear him with his pockets full of tomatoes to throw at the evangelists. And in spite of that, there was a phrase that got through to him that would not let him go. And it was from Joshua. Just that phrase, "As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord." And so on the morning he was to be married, he went out into a field and knelt down and committed himself to Christ. His friends were up in the tower pushing the hands back on the clock so it wouldn't look like the groom was late getting to his own wedding. At the reception, here's this bride who thinks she's getting a guy who throws tomatoes at evangelists. And the first she hears about it is the reception when he says, "As for me and my family, we're going to serve the Lord." She, understandably, was a little bit rebellious, and it was a while before she committed herself to Christ as well. That was the beginning of 8 generations to the present that have served the Lord. And the middle generation, the 4th generation, was Dr. Hudson Taylor, who started the China Inland Mission. And his great-grandson is in charge of the mission today. But when you think of the potential of generations and the influence of the family for the cause of Christ, one family, Hudson Taylor's family. And then I think about the man that was on the stump preaching, getting the tomatoes. He was one of 19 children, born in 21 years, girls. Can you imagine? Dear Susanna. But both John Wesley and his brother Charles, of course, started the Methodist movement. Charles wrote 700 hymns. 400 of those hymns have been published. If you're sitting in church sometime and just look back in the index and see how many hymns in your hymn book were written by Charles Wesley. And both of these young men said the greatest influence in their lives was their mother. Their dad was a pastor, but it was their mother that had the greatest influence on them spiritually. When John Wesley was starting a school in England, he wrote to his mother and said, "Tell me how you taught us so that I can use those principles in the school that I'm starting in England." In the Bible, we remember Eunice and Lois, the mother and grandmother of Timothy. And we really know very little about those women. Certainly, they never made the cover of Virtue magazine. We don't know if they led Bible study groups. We don't know if they were head of the Women's Missionary Society. All we know is that they gave the world a Timothy. And Paul said, they are the ones that taught Timothy the scriptures from infancy. And it was their godly example that Paul credited with transferring faith to this young man. And Paul, remember what Paul said about Timothy. He said, everybody else cares about their own things, but Timothy cares about the things of Jesus Christ. And so even if these women did nothing else, they gave the world a Timothy, and it's no small thing to give the world a Timothy. Jonathan and Sarah Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was probably the best known early American preacher. The revival early in our country in the 1700s was John Wesley. But there was a man named A.E. Winship who did a study in the early 1900s of 1,400 of the descendants of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards. And the result of this study is quite astounding. This marriage produced 13 college presidents, 65 professors, 100 lawyers, the dean of an outstanding law school, 30 judges, 66 physicians, the dean of a medical school, 3 United States senators, mayors of 3 large cities, governors of 3 states, a vice president of the United States, a comptroller of the United States Treasury, great numbers of ministers, missionaries, and lay leaders. And as he pored over the documentation, as he studied this, the letters, interviewing people who knew this family, he became overwhelmingly impressed that the real influence on these generations had been Sarah Edwards. Now, I think in this group, we, you know, our goal is not to produce United States senators and vice presidents of the United States and deans of medical schools, but it shows a family's contribution to our society and to the cause of Christ. And he felt the overwhelming influence of these generations had been this woman, Sarah Edwards. One of my favorite English preachers is named John Henry Jowett. And he's written books that I just absolutely love to read. He has this wonderful gift for taking the language, taking anything, and making you see spiritual truth in it. And so he just takes all kinds of situations and makes you love Jesus Christ as he opens this to you. Someone said to him, "How did you learn to do this?" He said, "From my mother. She taught me to see things inside of things." His mother was married to a drape maker in an industrial city in England. And we know nothing about her except she passed on this ability to her son. And I have his books. They're old and smell a little musty. And they give my heart a blessing every time I read them. And I think, that woman, we don't know anything about her, but her influence is permeating even to this generation. St. Augustine, his mother's name was Monica, and she became a Christian and was very, very distressed that her teenage son was very much following the way of the world, you know, wine, women, and song. And she prayed earnestly for Augustine. She went up to her priest, and this one priest had been a man who had brought many people to Christ. And she said, "You've got to talk to my son. You've got to promise me you'll talk to my son." And he said, "I won't talk to your son." And she could, you know, she was just, "What is this?" And he said, "It is not possible that the son of all these tears could be lost." And of course, he's one of the great church fathers, St. Augustine. You think of the Bible of Hannah. You think of not only her prayers and heart for God, where she was put in a position to conceive by faith, but then when she sent her young son, maybe 5 years old or whatever, off to live in a far from ideal situation. And I can't believe that she who prayed so earnestly for him to be conceived, didn't pray earnestly for him as she knew that she would only see him year after year. But to pray that God would protect him from that evil influence, and that he would have a heart for God, and that the Lord might stir him, that he might be sensitive to the Lord's voice, all those things that we see happening in Samuel's life. And, you know, we know that every year she made a robe for him. And I just picture her there as she's sewing the robe, you know, doing the stitches, saying, "God, you know, give him a heart to hear your voice. Give him a heart to serve. Keep him from the evil influence of Eli's sons." And, you know, women of influence. In Jeremiah 35, the Lord tells Jeremiah, "Invite the Rechabites into the side room of the temple and offer them wine." This passage moves me so deeply, because as Jeremiah invites these men in and offers them wine, they say, "Oh, we don't drink wine." Our forefather, Jonadab, told us not to drink wine, not to plant vineyards, not to plant crops, not to build houses, and there's this whole list of things he told us not to do. And for all these many generations, we have obeyed our forefather Jonadab. And then the Lord turns to Jeremiah. And this is a paraphrase, but I think it captures the spirit of what the Lord says to him. "Oh, that I had people who were faithful to me for generations. Like these people, Gentile people have been faithful to their forefather Jonadab." And so one of the things I pray is that God would allow us to be the beginning of generations who would be faithful, that all my children would love and serve him, and that he would bring to them spouses who have a heart to love and serve him, and that God would intervene in the coming together, in the union of sperm and seed, that all my grandchildren and all my great-grandchildren and all my great-great-grandchildren until Jesus Christ comes again would all love and serve him. In Psalm 78, listen for the idea of generations as I read this. "I will utter hidden things from of old, things we have heard and known, things our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power and the wonders he's done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children." Now, as navigators, we are very moved by the whole concept of reproduction, aren't we? The thought of being able to pour our lives into someone, and they in turn would pour their lives in, and that our lives would be multiplied for generations. And there are generations here at this conference. The woman who discipled me was a year ahead of me in college. She's here at this conference. And so if we started doing that, we could see grandmothers and mothers and children and grandchildren probably at this conference. And this is the thing that I pray for our families as well as for our ministries. In Isaiah 1:2, this is the passage where the Lord, the perfect Father, complains that he has rebellious children. Now, what I am not saying in doing this, that as women of influence, as women who have a heart to see our children faithful for generations, that's not something we can do. It isn't the idea that if I'm a really good mother, everything's going to turn out right. If I do the best I can, God is obligated to somehow, you know, make everything turn out right. Because in this passage, God, who is the perfect Father, says, I have raised rebellious children. And so, just to put in a context, I'm not trying to communicate to you a gospel of works here. That if you just do enough, if you do the right things, if you never make a mistake, you know, everything's going to turn out right. But what I am saying is that God has on his heart that he would see generations of the faithful in our families. And I think that's a worthy vision for us also. And I think that it does change the way we operate in our homes, the vision that we have for our families. We also need to look at our values, because our values affect the way we approach our mothering task. We need to ask God to help us reevaluate what is really important. Lord, what do you think is important? We live in a society today that tells us we can have it all and we can do it all. Helen Gurley Brown is the editor of Cosmopolitan. You know, that's the magazine with the cleavage at the, you know, as you pass it at the grocery store. She's written a book called Having It All. And I would say that if there has been one message that's been given to women in the 80s is you can have it all, you can do it all, you can be anything you want. And that's really a lie, because we can't do it all. We can't have it all. Life is made up of choices, and our values and our vision determine our choices. And I think it's a very tragic thing to come to a point in your life where all of a sudden you realize you've lived your life for all the wrong things just because you never stopped to reevaluate what was really important. And so this section of the workshop is for that purpose, to give us time to pause and to think, Lord, do I value what you value? Or have I kind of bought in to the philosophy of the 80s? The philosophy of the 80s has told women that to be a wife and a mother is, you know, if you're intelligent and capable, that is really not a big enough job for you. I was on a panel with some teenagers when we lived in Washington State. I was involved in the public schools, and they asked me to be on this panel with these kids, and we had a dinner before. And so this one teenage fella and I were sitting together at dinner, and we were talking, and afterwards he said, by the way, what do you do? And I said, I'm a homemaker. And he said, really? He said, you seem so intelligent. But not only have we told women in the 80s that being a wife and a mother is not a challenging enough job for them if they're capable, but the more tragic part is that I believe women have believed it. USA Today did a survey of people over 65. The second biggest regret that people over 65 had was that they had given so little thought and attention to their children's development. And so one of the things that's helped me is to think, okay, when as I stand today, what is it I will wish I had done 20 You know, in 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, what will I wish I had done today? Because things look different day by day than they look with a 30-year perspective. When we lived in Tucson, Arizona, and my children were little and we had men living with us, I noticed that as it approached supper time, there were days when I would go into it was somewhere between a coma and a depression. And I thought, now why is it right before supper, some days I feel so awful? And as I evaluated it, I realized that I knew that Roger and the men would soon be coming home for dinner. And if I had checked a lot off my do list and everything that was visible and tangible was done, I felt good about my day. But on the days when I did not feel good about my day, I'd ask myself the questions, did I have good time with the Lord? Yeah, I did. Did I have good time with my kids? Yeah, I did. Did I make people more important than things? I did. Then why do you feel bad? It's because the house isn't pulled together, you know? And I realized then that if I lived for what made me feel good at the end of every day, I would live for all the wrong things. And 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now, I would live with regrets. Because God says it's what is invisible and what is eternal that has value, not what is visible and tangible. And you know you have to talk to yourself on that one, because that one doesn't come easy. And you fight it over and over and over again. And you think, what are they going to think? But I've often thought that very few of us will sit in a rocking chair with a cat on our lap, with our knitting, you know, with our bones have already kind of, you know, shrunk us down. And we're rocking in our chair and we say, always had a clean bathroom. And I don't think we'll even say, always had a big ministry. And I think for Navigator women in particular, how many of you have ever heard a message on the Navigator wife? Oh, good. I'm glad that's dying. Good. We should not feel the pressure to be anything other than women who love and want to follow God. And we should look as different in our homes, in our ministries, as there are women here. We should not all look alike. We've talked about our vision. We've talked about our values. I could add one more, our commitment. We know as navigators about commitment. And we know it's not in coming up with the fantastic ideas that make things happen. It's after you've got that fantastic idea, it's the grit and the tears and the sweat and the blood and the, you know, all that to make something happen. And so I'd just like to encourage you again, just in your commitments to your families, to just evaluate, am I giving my best outside my home and giving my family the leftovers? Now, I don't mean an ingrown perspective, because I think the pendulum can swing either way, and where we can be so focused in on our families that it's destructive to our families, it's destructive to us, and it certainly doesn't help the work of Christ. But I think it's easy to always be making our applications to our neighbor or somebody in our Bible study and not really giving the kind of thought and effort within our own families. And so let me just challenge you to the commitment. Years ago, when we were living in Tucson, by the end of the school year, I was disturbed by the effects I was seeing on my elementary school kids of just peer influence. And I thought, now this summer's coming. How can I draw them again under my influence again? And so I had this wonderful idea. I thought I could take them to the pool every day. We had three city pools within 5 minutes, and they were all free. We could blitz the house in the morning. We could go to the pool. We could come back and have lunch. They could take their rest. I could do a craft with them. And then late afternoon, then they could have their friends over to play. But I'd be limiting the amount of influence, amount of time with their friends, and I'd be the primary influence in their lives again. So I was sharing this with Georgia Drake, an older mother that some of you know. And I said, what do you think of that? And she said, well, you've got to make it happen. And it was that little terse comment that kept me going the whole summer, because I thought, it's not coming up with the ideas. That's the easy part. It was day after day trying to think, how do I keep this going and how do I make this happen? And at any point, I could have just kind of caved in and said, this is not worth it, which you feel like a lot of times. But I thought, Lord, I believe this is what you want me to do. And so the commitment to follow through. I'd like to turn it over to you now. I'd like to find out what you came hoping to receive. And we'll tailor the rest of our time to you. Jeannie. Yeah, I think so. Sometimes, you do whenever, I think whenever you become a primary influence again, there can be a change just by virtue of the amount of time they're with their friends. Why did you come?
We don't want to give our best outside our home and our register our family, and yet we don't want to become ingrown or family.
Exactly.
Or
right.
So if you have a question of any little guide or maybe guidelines for how we can gauge if we're becoming too ingrown.
Good. Let me just ask some of you what you use as a gauge to tell. I think one thing, just to preface this, while some of you can be thinking, each of our situations is not only unique, but each of our individual situations is unique month by month by month. And so I feel that an important thing is to be saying, God, at this point in my life, what is it I should be saying yes to and what should I be saying no to? And that changes. I remember a time when we hit a point where we were gone 3 nights a week, Raj and I both, on Bible study, and I said, you know, I just don't think this is good. And he said, you're right. This is not the way we want to live life. But this is a short-term thing, and for this period, this is what I really think we should do. And so I think there are times in your life when, because of your health, because of your personal stamina, because of the demands in the home, during the years when our children were young, I hardly ever left the house. But we had people living with us. The rallies were in the home. The Bible studies were in the home. I didn't need to. And someone has said, well, wasn't it awful having, you know, men living with you overseas, and you had, you know, like I was overseas 4 years and all three children were born during that time. We had guys live with us. My husband's mentally retarded brother came to live with us during that time. But it was having the men at the table that provided that stimulating conversation that, because I didn't have it any other place, it was wonderful. I mean, I felt that it was for my benefit, that it wasn't an added hard thing to have men living with us at that point. And so I think each person has to look. Some people have a lot more physical stamina, and so they can have lots of little children around, and they're still, you know, doing other things, and their families aren't neglected. There are other people that, whether it's their physical stamina or their emotional capacity, you know, sometimes you just feel like, I just feel like I'm just kind of holding my head above water at this point myself. And I remember a time on Okinawa, the doorbell rang, and I thought, I wonder who that could be. I went to the door and opened it. It was the girl that I met with. I didn't even remember it was the day she was coming. My tongue, I was so tired. My tongue was so thick. I just felt like, and my brain felt like hamburger. I thought, she doesn't have something to say. I think I'm going to cry, you know? And so there are, I think, at different times, different things. Like for me now, we have two in college. I have a 16-year-old at home. Roger and I have decided that I would only go away 2 weekends in the spring to speak at conferences and 2 in the fall. Cindy called me to come to Honolulu to speak, and I said, no, isn't that commitment? But I think you and your husband, you know, thinking through, what are the guidelines for our family? And if it's something in town where I can speak while Graham's in school, or where I can run while he's in gymnastics in the evening and do something for some women, I take those. But I'm not taking any weekends for, I'm scheduled for a long time now. Diane?
At one point, I was, in response to your question, I like to talk, and a lot of people know me know that, but I was involved with the WIC program. You may be familiar with that, Women and Children Program for the city of Washington, D.C. And what I did was counsel pregnant teenagers to encourage them to breastfeed their children because the baby has to start. And it seems like I had 5 children at the time. And you say, well, where do you have time to do all that? Well, I had already figured it out. Like you said, I had it by the time of my toddler, my 2 to 3-year-old, was going to a daycare for 2 hours a day. And during that time, I would go into the clinic setting and do my counseling. Most of my time revolved around the phone, where I would, you know, call up different patients and say, have you considered breastfeeding? Are you having problems with breastfeeding? And so forth. Now, it doesn't seem like very much, but what was doing was taking my mental distraction, was mentally distracting me from my home, and I loved to escape at times. That was my escape. And so needless to say, it was my excuse also not to concentrate on the home. Like children I love, but it became a burden at times. And my husband basically could see me from a distance better than I can. And so when I got pregnant with number 6, he said, this is it. So I did stop. It was hard to stop because, you know, I was feeling good about what I was doing. You feel good about yourself. And I think that's why a lot of women do go outside the home to do things and feel like someone else is not as selfish as my children and my husband. You know, you want to feel like you get a pat on the back if it doesn't go out. But I realized my motivation was to escape. And I say, if that's my motivation, then I should enjoy doing what God called me to first. And until I get to that point, and I know I don't need to, even though I may be gifted at this area of doing counseling outside of home, until I can be content and satisfied with what God called me to, your main purpose. And so now, on Wednesday mornings, when I take my daughter, now what do I just say? Oh, okay, I need to clean the house. You know, rather than thinking I could call clients up and counsel them on the phone, I try to commit myself to doing the best job I can at that moment. And then in the future, I feel God is just preparing me for later on in ministry.
That's right.
This is all preparation.
I feel like the same things you do in ministry transfer to your children. You're not getting behind by ministering to your children because you'll learn things there that then you can transfer. And so it's a continuous thing. Some of the things that have been raised, I'd like to just make a couple comments on before we continue. One is this whole area of what is immediate satisfaction. It can be a clean house. It can be some kind of service where you're getting immediate feedback that makes you feel good. And you know your kids don't do that. And so that's why you have to have a vision for what you're doing, because I think we need more internal motivation than our husbands do, because they're always off to conferences and they're in stimulating meetings and people are encouraging them. We don't have that. We've got to have it well up from inside. We need to give it to each other to keep us on track. So immediate satisfaction can come in lots of areas. The other is this whole area of escape. We do need some time away from our kids legitimately. And one of the things I would encourage you to do is to pray for either a person, either a babysitting situation where you can be, where you can have your kids cared for from morning to week, or pray for a friend that has a philosophy that's compatible with yours, where you would take her children on Thursday morning and she would take yours on Tuesday morning. Then when you have that time, this is not the time to, you know, run to Safeway or to the malls. Oh, don't go to the malls. Take your Bible and a devotional book. Go to a nice tea shop and have a date with the Lord. Now, once you've, you know, you've bundled everybody up, you've packed the diaper bag, you've, you know, you've done all this stuff, and you've, the oven's turned off, and did you lock the front door and turn the heat back and all this, getting out. That is a huge jump from there to sitting down and opening your Bible sometimes. Don't you find it? So what I found helps is if you can find a devotional book that you can just dip into to help you jump that big gap. It may be, there are certain books for me that I just have to read a page and it kind of warms my heart. Or stirs me in some way where I can start praying and then open the Bible. But look for books that'll be books that you can use your whole life. You know, maybe not the same one every time. But authors who, when you read them, it's just like they just kind of light a little fire under you, warm you a little bit. And so go sit in the tea shop, take your notebook, maybe write about what's happened this week. Reflect and say, Lord, let me see how you've loved me this week. How have I done on loving my family? What are the things you're speaking to me about? Just take some time to write them out. Phyllis takes two mornings a week. Now, she doesn't have any kids that are home during the day. And Phyllis, just tell us a little bit how you approach your time, what you do.
Well, sadly, as you said, I've got my good office for 4 years to use.
And so, oh, yes, go ahead.
I also have a prayer almost every morning, but there's some mornings when, you know, your head is spinning and you have 100 things on your list and all that. And you think, Lord, I have had this time with you. I want you to be first in my life, so I can't even remember how to pray.
I know.
And then I go back to prayer and oh, yeah.
And just to be able to read, let the water run through your mind like it's running through a sieve, just the cleansing effect, the refreshment. Maybe take your verse pack and take a walk. Or I put my prayer cards are like this, and I just, they're easy to take with me. I just take them and take a walk and pray. If during that time, I haven't been doing this recently, but when my children were smaller, I used to inventory my children during that period, where I think through on each one of them individually, think, how have you put them together, Lord? And how can I be in step with you to just move them the next step? And I take time for a brainstorming list during this period. I think, what are fun things I could do to make our house a fun place? And I just write down all kinds of ideas. Now, that was the list I referred to the rest of the week when the kids would come and say, I'm bored. You know, well, often the days they're bored are the days you couldn't think of something creative to do if someone held a knife at your throat, you know. And, you know, you're thinking, it's going to take all my creativity to figure out what to have for dinner, you know. And so I'd look over this list and I'd think, well, I can't have them do this, this, or this because that involves too much supervision. But here's something that they could do today. And sometimes, it doesn't even have to be anything that fantastic. But I believe in the area of disciplining our children, I think the biggest mistake we make is that we leave our children on their own too much. And then we wonder why they've done something we wish they wouldn't have done. And so I think we need to be much more in charge of supervising their day, of planning for them. Some years ago, I took each of my children, we were on vacation, and they were getting older, getting into the teen years, and I thought, when they were little, I think I really know what made them feel loved. But now that they're getting older, do I know what makes them feel loved? So I made a little list to kind of prime the pump, and I took each one on a walk with this list. And I said, does it make you feel loved when Dad and I are on a trip and we bring you a gift? Does it make you feel loved when I scratch your back? Does it make you feel loved when I put a cartoon in your lunch bag? Does it make you feel loved when I put a note on your pillow? Does it make it you, you know, so I had this list to kind of get them started because, you know, you don't just say to somebody, what makes you feel, you know, what makes you feel loved? Well, as we went through the list, I could see with my three children, one might say, yeah, a gift. That's good. My daughter said, no, gifts aren't important to me. What makes me feel loved is if I feel like if people are really listening to me and take my ideas seriously. One said, I feel loved when I feel planned for. And my antenna went up. And I think this, you know, when your kids say, what are we going to do today? Or what's up today? They want you to have something in mind. It makes them feel like they're not backstroke. And even if it's, well, after I finish the dishes, we're going to take a little time to read a story. Or after lunch, we're going to take a walk today. And we'll go out and gather some dried things and maybe we could make a centerpiece for the table tonight. Or we're going to take chalk and go out and draw on the sidewalk. Or we're going to, you know, whatever. But that's why these times away, a morning away, helps you build your resources and gives you something that equips you for this. And so the times when I noticed my kids weren't behaving well, Where I started was with myself. I said, have I given them any good time today? Did I give them any good time yesterday? And because this is kind of my thing, you know, it's easy to deceive yourself, you know? I think, I really haven't. And so instead of disciplining them, I just stopped and thought, okay, what's something that'll give them some good eye-to-eye contact? And I call them all out in the kitchen and say, hey, let's do this. And a lot of times the problem's solved. I don't ever have to discipline them or correct them or whatever. And I don't mean that as a cure-all, but I think that's where you start. Uh-huh. I don't know how to evaluate that. Some of you may be able to. They're learning so much about infants and how they respond to eye contact. And they found that when a baby is making verbal noises, that if you respond to them within that second, that it seems to teach them something about interacting with people. I've just read some interesting studies on this recently. I think there is, they found that babies mimic your speech pattern. And so when mom talks to babies, they've tape recorded them, the cooing sounds they make is in rhythm with mom's speech patterns. When dad talks to them, the kids change their speech pattern. There's so much more to a baby than we begin to think. From the beginning, we used to put our hands on them, put it on their stomachs at night, and pray for them. And try and give them real attention, where you maybe put the infant seat on the kitchen table while you're working, and where you stop and you go over and you get down to their face and you just say, you are terrific, And where you're giving them every day that kind of thing. You hit points where you think maybe it's not so important anymore. Especially with boys, you get to an age where they don't want you to, they're kind of embarrassed by certain things. And yet they still want it. And you've got to figure out how to do it. And so I remember chasing my boys around and, like a monster and wrestling them down on a floor and blowing on their neck, you know how you do this, thing, and getting them laughing and all that, because they still need that physical affection. But to do it in the same kind of way you did when they were little doesn't work the same. But when I was on this panel that I was telling you about with teenagers, these were probably none of them Christians, but one of the gals said, why is it when you're a teenager, your parents stop hugging and kissing you? She said, when I'm down, my mother says, well, let me take you shopping. And she said, and what I want is for her to hug me. But see, that mother probably doesn't know it, because it can be hard to hug a teenager.
He gives me the morning off because I'm going to be medic in the morning, and then he takes the afternoon off to suffer.
Excellent.
He doesn't need a nap.
Good plan. That's excellent.
And Arthur, 6-4-2, it's been a little hard this summer during that, but that's what we're working on. We've at least got 3.5 to 4.
Very good. Very good. Yes.
And all your examples in the beginning were so motivating on the mother's influence and such. And I wonder, I think, why do we feel so insecure as mothers to lead our children spiritually? Maybe you think that they're supposed to be spiritual as
Well, I'm not sure if I know exactly what's the root of your question. Is it our insecurities, or that dad's supposed to be the spiritual head? Okay. Okay, now, this, when someone is given the responsibility of being a head, doesn't mean they need to do, they don't need to think up the ideas necessarily. They don't even need to necessarily execute them. And it can still be under their headship. Like, I think for a lot of our husbands, they've given lots of thought to lots of people and their job and their responsibility. And for some of them, they would be very, very glad if we would do the thinking, some of the thinking for the family, and then give them the ideas, you know, and they could help do this. And so Roger has really appreciated that I would do certain thinking for the family, plan things, and he'll come in and I'll say, hey, tonight I was thinking, how about if we try doing something like this? And he'd say, great. And I'd say, would you like to do this part? Sometimes he'll say, yeah, you know, and I'll just fill him in and he'll do it. Sometimes he'll say, you've got more of the pulse beat of what you're trying to accomplish. Go ahead, you know, and do it. And so there are times when, as working as a team, you know, he'll say to me, Gene, I think you're making too big a deal over, you know, this issue. Or I'll say to him, you know, I'm getting some feedback from the kids that they really are feeling that you're not around enough. But we need to give that kind of feedback to each other. And I think there are certain things that we have a feel for that we need to communicate to them. Because if their families are not going well, their ministry is going to be curtailed in the long run. Conversely, they see things we don't. Roger was away on a trip for, I don't know, a week, 10 days or something, and he came back and he said to me, you're talking too much. And what he observed was, I was saying to Graham, pick up your toys. Graham, Mom said, pick up your toys. Honey, pick up, you know, and he said, you know, move in there, you know, don't you know. Well, see, I had been with the kids, and my vision had just closed down like this. I wasn't seeing things well again. But he came in as a, you know, a unaffected observer from this trip and just said, you know, I can see what's happening. You can't see what's happening. But, you know, step in here. Well, see, that's the kind of teamwork we need to cultivate with one another. And, yeah, Phyllis. I did, yeah. Yes. Exactly. Right. Go ahead.
And I feel dependent. This is every day, but what's workable for me and my large family?
Yes.
person in this prayer, but always remember, God is sovereign over that man. He hears my prayer.
That's it.
You know, he can't do anything or not do anything that God has not allowed. And I said, I've got a relationship with God, too.
That's right.
And I can pray him down.
Yes.
That's what I feel. You know, my family, my husband, you know, he's not big enough. He's not bigger than God. He's a choleric, but what does it make any difference?
That's right.
So I could pray, and if I, and I could, he could either change him or change the situation. And then I have rest. If he ever changed him, then I have, God said, well, it's probably something else.
Good. And the thing is, sometimes we think it has to be something so big or has to take a certain form. And we feel so defeated because you think, you know, my personality and my kid's personality does not lend itself to what I have in my mind that I should be doing as far as devotions or this kind of thing. And so it may look very, very different. But ask God to give you creative ideas, and it may be while you're riding with him to the airport to pick your husband up that you say, you know, let me just tell you about, I listened to this tape about this missionary that was captured. Let me tell you, you know, and just tell the story. Or say, you know, I'd appreciate if you'd pray for me about this, and consider that your input. It's the idea of just feeding, but what you don't want it to sound like is teaching. You know what I mean? In the sense where kids all of a sudden think, you know, I've had enough of this, you know? Yeah. And it's the idea there of whetting the appetite. It's the idea of, in Israel, when a baby was born, they stuck their finger in this stuff, stuck it in the baby's mouth, and it kind of, and that's what got them, their sucking thing started, you know? I mean, that's what they did. Well, that is kind of the idea on this teaching, is whetting their appetite, getting them going. And it doesn't have to be a lot. And sometimes it may turn into a session where, you know, these wonderful things, these are the things you're always hoping for, where you say something and one of the kids say, yeah, and like, you know, and then the other one jumps in and you've got this wonderful thing going and it goes on, you know. Then there are other times where you think, this isn't doing it, and you kind of shut it down. You know, you don't have to spend as long each time. Uh-huh. Well, when our children were elementary age, one night we came in and we were sitting in the floor, kind of the bedroom, bedtime ritual. And they said, tell us how you and Daddy fell in love. So we shared our story. Well, one of the things I had done as my time with them would be to tell them stories, serials at bedtimes. And so it would be a story that you tell so much and then you leave it off and then you pick it up the next night. Well, a lot of times, you know, I'd get there the second night and I'd say, what was that story about last night? You know, I couldn't remember to pick it up. But after we told our love story, then they said, tell us a serial and make it a love story. So I told the story of John and Sylvia. He was a high schooler who had gone on a, like, teen mission type thing to this foreign country, and he met this girl. She was the daughter of missionaries. And so it's what I tried to do was to include the things that I think make up a healthy courtship and friendship. And so each night we'd continue the story with John and Sylvia. And so I'm telling about, you know, just their friendship and their sharing, and then it's time to go off to college, and they go to the same college, and they get to know each other, and finally they get married, and they end up in India as missionaries, and one morning they find this baby on their doorstep that's been deserted and it's handicapped, and they bring it in, and you know, and so soon they've got like three children that people have brought to them that nobody wants, and they're taking care of them. Well, then eventually Sylvia is pregnant, and my kid said, "You mean John and Sylvia had intercourse?" Well, what this did was it showed me that in their training, they had the wrong idea about sex and marriage. Well, then that just, okay, I see where I need to do some teaching. But it was just, I mean, they were devastated that this godly couple.
So, like, my son just had he's fifth grade now, and they began to teach A's in high school and school. And all these kids came back and said, "Mommy, guess what? This teacher came back, and our health teacher said he said those things called A's, and then the way you get it is what's that, Mommy?" And he said, "And you have to use what's that word, Mommy?" Oh. Not to stop what I was doing and give a sex education.
I know it.
I think sometimes we compartmentalize our life too much, and I definitely don't have a hand on this, but one of the things I try to do is do fun, creative things with my son. I'm not 18 months, I'm not an expert at all. and plan an outing, like the lake, with a couple similar to the wife, and I've even took it a step farther, and I invite a Japanese girl I was meeting with, and her little boy, to go along with this. So try to model outreach and relationship with others in a young Christian, and also spend the time. And sometimes, you talk to me now because the kids are going off. And sometimes the kids go and play to each other and get by and
things
like that. So if we could just try and, I've been consulting with, I've got to give up ministry completely to be a mother, or I've got to give up mother's
right. Right. Right.
Along with that, and I wanted to ask for some feedback on a comment that Phil made last night about that motherhood is not your purpose but your platform. And I kind of want to get some feedback on that comment. Won't you, expand on that?
Won't you, Phyllis? Why don't you start? I think to realize that our kids are not a hindrance to the ministry. They are part of the ministry. That's part of what God has ordained at this time in our life to be our ministry. And I remember, I love to sit down with one person eye to eye. Now, Roger tells me that the house could fall down around me if I'm meeting with someone. Like, there'll be some, we're on the couch and the children were young, and he'd come in and he'd say, "What was that?" And I'd say, "What?" And he'd say, "I'll check on it." And he'd, after she'd leave, he'd say, "I can't believe that you tune out so much." So, for me, I am not a good one for, like, you know, jostling the kids on my foot while I'm talking to somebody or, you know, that sort of thing. But when you like to really get in deep heart-to-heart conversation with people, and I had been around the Navigators as a single woman. We were married 3 years before our first child was born, so I was involved in ministry there. Then finally you have your kids come along, and there can be a frustration where you feel like, I can't minister. But it's because it's not exactly the way it used to be. I remember times when we'd have the gang over, and I was down with these little kids, and I was taking them off to the potty and to bed and doing all this. And I think, here I am, I hear them out there singing and, you know, studying the Bible, and I'm back there, and, you know, and I think, you know, I'm just not able to minister. Well, as I thought about it, I thought, you know, I could sit down and show them how to have a quiet time, and tell them later how to become a mother, how to be a mother. Or I can have somebody tell them how to have a quiet time, and I can show them how to be a mother. I've had people who are involved in the ministry then write to me and say, you know, I have kids now, and I can't believe how much of little pictures of seeing you with your kids has come back to me and has affected the way I am trying to be a mother. We met in D.C. a pastor and his wife, and they said, just want you to know that we have modeled our family and our ministry after you and Roger. So I said to Roger, they were in our home twice 3 years ago. I mean, 13 years ago. Twice 13 years ago. We've seen them maybe at, a Christian booksellers conference or had a dinner with them when we were passing through their town or something like that. And, I mean, I can't imagine. And so part of being a woman of influence is doing the thing that God's called you to at this time in your life. What I think is such a temptation is you'll hear at a conference like this so many challenges in so many different directions that you can leave feeling supercharged for the first week and then tremendously depressed, or you can make peace with God saying, God, I know my life will not look the way it does today, a year from now, 5 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, but at this point in my life, what should I be doing, and what should I say no to? And there were points in my life. Now, when the children were small, we always had people living with us. We always had things going on at the house. So I didn't feel like I needed to leave, and I didn't. But there were often Navigator pressures saying, why don't you go on campus? We could really use you, and this sort of thing. And I felt, in obedience to God, that was not the right thing for me to do. And Roger has said, the way that you kept certain parameters on your life then is the thing that's giving you a message now. And I think that's true.
I have a question about the use of your time on that morning away.
Yes.
Did you ever go with the intention of doing a Bible study, or was it really free?
Well, I am a firm believer in Bible study, not for completion, but for ministry to the heart. And I think when you do, what are the ages of your children?
8, 6, 4, 2.
Yes. So it's hard to kind of find the time often to get your study done. And I would encourage you to use that time for the Lord to really minister to you. And if that can be done doing your Bible study, which I think it would be wonderful if you would do some Bible study and be touched by a thought and stop and pray and reflect and enjoy the Lord in the midst of it. But if it becomes a time of just, again, that pressure of cranking something out, no. One of the things that helps me tremendously, and I think especially when you have little children that might be helpful to you, is whatever I'm working on, Bible study, devotionally, I put in a little file folder and I carry it with me. And it may not work as well if you're always, every time you go in the car, you have all the kids in the car. But I carry it with me. I put it on the kitchen counter, and just seeing it sometimes reminds me of the content of the study. I'll be stopped behind a train, and it's 5 minutes, and everybody's, you know, just bored to death, and I have my study, you know. I may not write down one more thing, but I look at that thought, and I think, oh, God. You know, every truth in Scripture looks a little different every time you look at it, you know. And you're looking at it stopped for a train, and you see it a little different perspective. You look at it as you're washing dishes. There's just a little different twist to it. And I try to keep my study before me all the time. Then when I sit down to work on it, it's not like having to get yourself all in gear again. You know, you've been keeping the fire going the whole time. And so even if I don't get to write one more thing, and even if it's a red light, I just read that verse again, close it up. I think, oh, that's good. So you may want to try that. And let me just encourage you, once your children are in school, you are self-employed. I take all day Tuesday alone with the Lord. And I know you think, oh, I can't believe that. That's so wonderful. And your day will come. But I've seen many women, as they get to the stage where they could spend lots more time with the Lord, continue to live on the same kind of starvation diet that they did when their children were little. And so it's, to me, the most critical questions that you ask yourself, besides questions directly dealing with your relationship with the Lord, is, Lord, at this point in my life, what should I be saying yes to and no to? And I know it will not necessarily, I may be saying no to something that I dearly love. I feel like that's a way my gift could be expressed. It would just break my heart if I thought this would never be a part of my life again. But for this time, I gladly give it up because I can't do everything. I can't have it all. And in order to live by the right values and vision and with the right commitments, I have to say no to certain things now. And 6 months, 6 years, that may be a predominant part of my life. Yes. Good question. Some of you share some tips that have helped you balance housework and time with the kids. Mm-hmm. Sure. Good and loud.
We started homeschooling Jason this year for kindergarten, so I heard that when you homeschool, that you just don't do the housework. But the other aspect of it was that the kids do more chores. So Jason has trash details, Jan has India camper details for you, Jamie just does a thing or two. But so we start out the morning after breakfast with chores. Picking up the room, making beds, and making trash and all that stuff, getting the wash going. Then we start homeschooling from 8:30 to 10. And then we quit and go on a fun time, craft, fun time, go for a walk. Come back and eat lunch, do naps, and I have man-to-man time with Chase.
Mom to man.
Then I just finally just made up, I thought, oh, I'm not getting housework done, I'm having a great time with kids. So finally I just made up a cleaning schedule for myself, just like, you know, Monday was the bathroom, Tuesday was the kitchen. But when they were littler, I had a schedule where I did all my cleaning, whatever I had, and at 10 o'clock I stopped and played with the kids. So they knew at 10 o'clock that Mommy was cleaning up. I think I got that from you, Dean, when you came to the admission. But they knew
there's a difference between yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
It's clean my house once a week. Clean my house once a week, and then I straighten if somebody's coming home. But I just clean everything. So I don't clean in there if it's dirty out
there. Yeah. And one of the things I tell myself is people, when they come to our homes, they're coming not for food. They're coming for the real bread. And I think the food, the house, that's just a backdrop. The really important thing is the people. And also my kids. We live a lifestyle of having people over. It isn't like just every once in a while some people, you know, have visitors and guests. But for us, that's a lifestyle. And I feel like we don't want to set the pattern of putting our kids off because we're having company, because that is a whole lifestyle for us, you know. And so you may want to talk to your husband. He may want to just know that if he's going to be having people over, that, you know, either you need to plan the eating time so that he can have orange juice with the guests in the living room and he manages your daughter while you do the last half hour on the meal, or some kind of arrangement. But I think you and your husband maybe should talk, work as a team, and think, how do we do this? Because we don't want our kids feeling like, I hate to have company come over because that's when mom's grouchy and, you know. And then I think we need to say to ourselves, it doesn't matter if the house is not perfect, if the meal is not ready right on time, as long as you and your husband have talked it through. And I think there are all kinds of areas where part of ministering together is we need to learn to work together as a team. And so he may be thinking, okay, as soon as we come through the door, we want to eat because then we need to go on to the Bible study or whatever. And you may need to say, this probably is not going to work. I'm going to need at least a half hour after you get there for you to be, you know, to take care of our daughter so that I can do this last minute thing because she is just, you know, I just am not able to accomplish it. But I, yes.
I think what another thing I learned when I went to a workshop on meals. And I know this has been down as well, but he kind of emphasized he kind of got tired of some food and so I think because of that and other things, I really have the impression that people over here have to be fantastic. You always have to have all the right foods and have to do it and all that. And suddenly I realized with the number of people that Larry might show up with, they increase in time. This is not going to work. And so I'm just, you know, I finally get over the fact that I can sit there and say, well,
yeah, or, right, exactly.
I had a couple of my mom a couple of weeks ago from Charlotte. He's a pilot. And we had spaghetti. And lo and behold, we grated that show up in our house again. And I said, Larry, he says, oh, he pulled a Bible study for me. I said, what's she doing? He says, well, I think she should stay here with you. And I said, well, they don't have time to run back to the airbase and then come back here to a Bible study, so they're going to have to eat here. He said, yeah. I said, well, guess what? They're going to have spaghetti. But it was hard to say to them, I know a week ago you had spaghetti this house.
You know, we can, this is the whole idea of values. We can drain off precious emotional energy over things that don't matter. And we propagate it to our people. I've been to navigator functions where there was so much attention given to making sure everything was so perfect that people felt neglected. The table was beautiful, the, you know, and we need to rethink that. And people come to us wanting something real. And we have them in our home to share our lives, not our steak, you know. And I don't feel badly about having soup and salad and a bread for guests.
One of the frustrations I find when we have something in our home is not our, I kind of feel, I don't care anymore what I serve. That, but it's at meal time for the 2-year-old, the 1-year-old, I'm up and down, why is it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so frustrated, I can't enjoy it.
Yes.
Yeah.